Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, and welcome to Live Dharma Sunday. If you have called in to listen to this morning's broadcast, please note that all lines have been placed on mute to avoid background interference. If you are joining us from either the Bright Dawn Ning site or the Blog Talk Radio site, please note that it is not necessary to call in. If you're experiencing loss of audio or the Blog Talk Radio player is not working properly, please refresh your page and hit the play button once more. It may take a few moments for your browser to complete the buffering process. Once again, welcome to Live Dharma Sunday and enjoy the broadcast.
It just went off with timing. The washing machine.
Welcome, everyone, to Sunday Morning Live Dharma. This is Reverend Koyo Kubose here. And I'd like to tell you, start out this morning by sharing an experience that I had yesterday. We live in Central California, about a half an hour from Fresno, California. And the Fresno Buddhist temple had a big event yesterday. It was a observance of Shinran Shonin's 750th memorial observation, observance. And Shinran, 13th century Japanese Buddhist monk, and very brief biography. He lost his father when he was 4 and his mother when he was 9, and he came from a very religious family. And the story goes that when he was 9 years old, he said tells his relatives he wants to become a monk, and they said, okay, we'll take care of that, certain ceremonies to do that, set that up for the next week or so. He goes, no, right now. He didn't want to wait. Okay. So he became a monk at the age of 9 and went to live at Mount Hiei, which is outside of Kyoto, Japan, overlooking right between Kyoto and Lake Biwa. At that time, in the 1200s, the center of Japanese Buddhism. The Tendai sect was the dominant religious denomination, and it was the center of learning. Very powerful, very prestigious place. And they have a lot of austere practices, meditation and walking around the mountain in all kinds of weather, doing walking meditation. Very severe. I've seen a movie on what they call their 1,000-day training period, where they hardly ever sleep, and they it's really extreme. But anyway, so Shinran spent 20 years applying himself very diligently, studying and doing all kinds of practice, but he couldn't get satisfaction. And then he met his teacher, Honen, who taught him about the Nembutsu. And Honen was a sort of a revolutionary figure at the time, where instead of all the practices, severe practices, he said, I want to practice that everybody can get enlightenment through. Everyone. Not just those who can apply themselves with severe discipline. There must be a way for the Buddha's teachings to be accessible to everyone. Farmers, merchants, people who cannot devote, you know, all their time to severe religious practices and rituals and so forth. And reciting the name of Amida Buddha, Nembutsu practice, sincere recitation, and Shinran, after 20 years, he's ready. And he found a teacher in Honen. And both he, Honen, and Shinran was this outstanding disciple, were not seen very positively by dominant elite priests of the time, because they were kind of rivals. They said that you don't necessarily have to do all this stuff. Okay? And religious institutions are very conservative. They don't like challenges. And they're aligned with the ruling political administration of the time. They have a lot of political power. There's no separation of church and state there. And so they were banned, exiled, Honen and Shinran, and stripped of every status and everything. And Shinran had to go live in a faraway province. And he went from an elite monk to an ordinary person, so to speak. And he lived in the farming village. And he came to realize that religion has to change to reach the people. Religion is not just for the learned and the elite, cloistered in the monastery. And after his exile, you know, things changed, so forth. He was allowed to come back. And he had a long career of teaching, writing. Even though he's quoted and said, I don't have one single disciple. He didn't consider himself a great teacher. He was a very humble, simple man. But he had very sincere, a lot of commitment. And 750 years later, his influence is very strong, and they're commemorating his memorial of his passing. They observe a big observance every 50 years of his passing. So the last big one was, of course, they do a little one every year, but 750th year now, 50 years later, at the 800th memorial service, there'll be a big one. But the point here is, there was a speaker, Sacramento, as part of the program yesterday, and he mentioned what I just sort of mentioned in his brief biography, and he said, you know, Buddhism is about change. You know, that's another way of saying impermanence, and you have to change with the times, and Buddhism always followed this. When it spread from its birthplace in India and it went to different cultures, It always changed because it has to communicate to the people. Okay. It's translated in, you know, into the language of the people, and culturally it has to adapt itself. You have to change. Okay. And should not change things. You know, before, elite monks were celibate. They had to know alcohol. They had a lot of precepts. Shinran was broke tradition. It was a big deal for him to become married. He had children. He became a householder. And the speaker, Koichi Mizushima Sensei, said the young man, very vibrant, charismatic speaker, from Sacramento, said, you know, Shinran, he sort of did the opposite of what, instead of doing all the austere practices and everything, he went in the opposite direction. He not only changed things, but he changed it dramatically. And you find a lot of great spiritual leaders do that, whether you're talking about Jesus or Gautama Buddha or, you know, had great social impact. The challenge the caste system, shake up the whole hierarchy. Sometimes you have to do the opposite of what the natural tendency is. And what I like about the speaker is that, you know, have you ever been in a dark room? You close the door and it's dark. What do you do? You want to see. You guys real white. Want to see in this dark room. It's actually what you should do is you should close your eyes, because then your eyes will become habituated to the dark faster. And if you try to open your eyes wide to see, but that's your natural instinct. When it gets dark, you open your eyes real wide, you know. But you say you should close your eyes and increase the darkness so that your eyes will dark adapt quicker. And see, when religious institutions are challenged by change, they shouldn't just dig in. They should be open. They should want to grow. And this speaker, Mizushima Sensei, said, "Hey, I'll tell you this another story about this kid who was trying to hit a baseball. You know, how you throw a ball up and then you try to hit it." And he said that he had an uncle who was sitting on the porch watching him, and he was a grouchy old uncle. And this kid threw the ball up and swung and missed. And the grouchy uncle said, strike one. And then the kid picked up the ball, kind of loosened up his shoulders, threw the ball up again, swung and missed again. And the grouchy old uncle said, strike two. Then the kid really gets ready and loosens up, throws the ball up real high, and he missed again. And the uncle says, strike three, you're out. And the boy picked up the ball and bat and came back toward the porch where the uncle was sitting, and the boy was smiling. And the uncle said, "What you smiling about? You just struck out." And the boy said, "Yeah, I'm a fantastic pitcher." So the speaker said, "You know, you have to change your perspective. You know, that's the secret to many things, even the secret to life, how you turn a negative into positive. It's your attitude, your perspective." Okay. And I'm reminded of one of the students in our lay program who gave the example of a person who came into a child's room, and I guess he had shot a lot of arrows. They didn't go into details, but rubber-tipped arrows, a lot of them shot all over the room, And each arrow was right in the middle of a circle. Center bullseye, every shot. He goes, wow, this kid. And then one time he came in when the child was actually shooting, and he saw that the kid shot an arrow, and then he went over there and he drew the circle around the arrow that was sticking onto the wall. This is the secret of you have to draw a circle around the arrows. This is where there's arrows all over. The arrows are the Dharma truths and teachings that are all around us. We're the ones that have to draw our circle, ourselves, so that that teaching hits the bullseye. We don't wait for so that we aim an arrow right at the bullseye and see how skillful we are to hit it. We change ourselves. Great teaching requires great listening. It's not waiting for some external perfection to transform us. We have to transform ourselves. So, in other words, Shinran, you might say, he changed things. That's the way I phrased it. He changed things. But really, that means he changed himself. Okay. Well, today, we're honored to have a guest for our Dharma Glimpse. He's Tomaseo Demann, who lives in Las Vegas. He is currently in our Lane program. And as part of his spiritual journey during a 5-year period, he said that he did Zen meditation. And as he says, but it did take. And he says he has found his home in the Pure Land tradition. And in Las Vegas, they have a sangha there. And he participates in there. And he's been a very good student in our program. So for today's Dharma Glimpse, Tomaseo-san.
Thank you. Am I coming across okay?
Yes, very good.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Reverend, for giving me this opportunity to share a little bit here. I have been on the Buddhist path for some time now, but I originally came from a religious background that had commandments, which is fine. One of the commandments was, thou shalt not kill. It's very commendable. But unfortunately, the way I think it came across is this just referred to people. And I'm pretty convinced I know that for sure. We used to watch everybody pack the churches on Sundays. And deer season back in Michigan started, I think it was approximately a week before Thanksgiving. And when that happened, everybody was gone. Businesses were just, they slowed down to a screeching halt. The whole town was way, way up north where all the deer are. And I remember we used to have debates with relatives saying, how can you kill these innocent creatures? And their justification was always, but they'll starve to death if we leave them out in the woods. I never bought that, but that's the way it was. We're not going to get into any argument with anybody, especially a relative. I came across the Buddhist path, and as you know, we have precepts. And the very first precept is against killing any sentient being. You know, I saw that and I went, whoa, I think I'm going to like this. So I stopped to do a lot of thinking, and my question was, what is a sentient being? And after much contemplation, I came up with an answer, which was, it is a being that has feelings and has emotions. And I was pretty comfortable with that. But how can I really prove that? At our house here, we have what's called a Japanese fantail betta fish. It's a very, very beautiful fish. And it's just in a simple bowl, humble home. But once a week, we change the water. So we give him a little cleaning. And week after week after week, for as long as we've had him, when he gets scooped up and goes into the temporary bowl, this fish just is totally terrified. And again, I want to emphasize, it's week after week after week, but there is nothing but this fear in him. He's just shaking, and he's so nervous, and tries to jump out of the net. Well, this has to be a sentient being. We also adopted a greyhound a few years back. Now, if you know anything about greyhounds, and this is an ex-racer, by the way, they are as elusive as cats. They do what they want, when they want, and they spend most of their existence just laying around sleeping. They don't know how to play, and on the positive side, they don't bark. I mean, just rarely. So it's a very peaceful and calm dog to have around the house, and you can't fall in love with them immediately. But as I just said, they don't have any emotions. They're so elusive. But I think they do have emotions. My wife went on a business trip a few years ago, and I was home with the dog, and a couple days later she arrived back home. I knew what time she was expected in the house, so I took the dog in the bedroom, and he heard her voice, and he bolted for the door, charged up to the door, and this emotionless animal was jumping on her. Now, our dog does not jump, he doesn't go on the couch, he's not in the bed ever, but he was on his hind legs and he had all 4 feet up in the air. He was happy to see her. That has to be just nothing but true emotion. They really are sentient beings. A couple more examples. Have you ever owned more than one pet at a time? I know I have. And what happens when one of the pets is no longer there, when it dies? I've noticed the other pets walk around and they roam like they're lost. Something is not right. They're unsettled. They miss their old comrade. I also remember one time back home in Michigan, I was on business and I was driving through just close to the downtown area, and somehow a deer had found its way onto the freeway. And as I got close to the deer, it had been hit by a car. It was laying on its side, desperately trying to get up. But I think the hind legs were probably broken, and it was bleeding from the ears and the mouth. That look that animal had on its face is really something I will never, ever forget. Doggone it, I can't kill any kind of an animal. That was just so sad, but of course that was unintentional. And Michigan is loaded with duck hunters, pheasant hunters, turkey hunters. I remember one time we were on a small vacation when duck season opened. We were by the lake, and boy, all you could hear was gunshots. The hunters out in the boats shooting these duck as they flew over. And I know I got upset, and my wife was very, very upset. We just couldn't handle that. So, okay, the larger animals do have feelings then. They are sentient beings. But what about the little small creatures? I remember I used to have an LP with Bill Cosby routine on it. And I remember his wife, Camille, used to start screaming in the room, "A bug, kill it!" And Bill Cosby used to answer back to her, "Kill it! I can't even see it!" So people are afraid of even these little bitty things. And about a month ago, we had an attack in our home of ants. Not sure where they came up from, but they found their way to our kitchen counter. And I remember on a Sunday night, I walked in the room and I went, "Oh my, we had ants all over." Well, there's no way that I can go and squash an ant, no matter how much I don't want them in the house. So I got out a little Tupperware container, a little piece of scrap paper, and I was scooping these up in this little Tupperware container, getting as many as I could, would take them outside, and just let them go, let them be at peace. We live in a desert here in Las Vegas, and we are invaded by spiders. It's just a part of living here. And we'll get many spiders in the house, and there we are again with our Tupperware containers. And I do it. My wife does it. I know sometimes I'll come home from work, and I'll say, okay, what did you catch? Because I saw a container sitting on the Rubbermaid pad. And they have to have these feelings too, because if you've ever tried to catch the spider, to put him in his container, they scurry as fast as they can, or quite often they will roll up in a ball, apparently as a protection mechanism, that, okay, I'm not here, you can't see me, I'm dead. And then if you just leave them for a minute thinking that they are dead, they'll get up and start taking off again. So we spend a good part of our days to catching them in here. It's just something that we can't do. We can't kill another being, and I hope other people are like that too. But we have been here for many lifetimes in the cycle of birth and death. And it is said that when Buddha became enlightened, he remembered his many lifetimes. There were good lives that he had and some that weren't so good. And it made me stop to think when I was preparing this, was I a bug at one time? And all I could come up with an answer was, probably. Yesterday in town here, we had the Susan G. Komen race for the cure. I assume this happened in all the cities across the country. And this was a race to save lives by finding cure for breast cancer. A very commendable cause. And I started thinking about this, and I went, what about if there was a race called the Shakyamuni Buddha Race for the Elimination of Ignorance? And that would be to save the life of all sentient beings. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's great. That's great. As I listen to this Dharma glimpse, a lot of associations came into my mind, and so I'm going to sort of shift courses and not talk about what I was going to talk about, and I'd like to continue on this topic. You know, that one of the dominant religions of Shakyamuni Buddha, Gautama Buddha's time, and it's still a good religion, is the Jains, J-A-I-N, the Jain religion in India. And I remember they're famous for, you know, they have reverence for all life, including insect life. And so, to minimize possibly stepping on an insect when they're walking outside, they sweep ground in front of them as they walk. And I think this is this made me think, there's a dimension or a continuum. I don't think there's an absolute standard. Everybody has to do their own best in their lifestyle. For one thing, depending upon your definition and so forth of things, you can't absolutely not kill anything as long as we're alive. Some people, they say, well, even if fruits, vegetables, plant life are living things, whether they have emotions or not might be a question, but there's some research that says that even plants have emotions, maybe that's controversial, but that's not the point. The point might be, well, if someone feels that even plants, that they don't want to to kill a plant by picking the fruit off the tree and stopping its natural course of life, so they don't pick any fruit. They wait for the fruit to drop. Things like this. And of course there's vegetarians, and there's a whole movement saying don't use meat products, leather or other products, how extreme does one take it? Well, my view is, you do what your own path is unfolding, how it's unfolding. We all come from different, I guess you call it, karmic backgrounds, and our path is evolving. There's no absolute standard that, everyone must do exactly like in this way. That's, very unrealistic and not, a truthful unfolding. There's all kinds of flowers that there are different seeds, and they're all in different environments. Some are near the ocean, some are in the desert, some are in get a lot of sun, some get a lot of water, some don't. They're all blooming according to their own karmic background, evolving. And people are the same way. So we can't expect everyone to be the same kind of generic mold. We can only ask each of us, everyone, only can ask ourselves to be as sincere as we can as our path unfolds. So we don't compare to other people. We don't judge other people. Okay? We understand background, person, place, and thing, person, place, and time. Okay? Things depend upon person, place, and time. Depends upon who you're talking about, when in their life you're talking about them, okay? In what context. This is right understanding when you talk about ethical behavior or understanding a person's behavior. And I was one time I bought a snowblower, and we found a model that we wanted, and we drove out to the suburbs. This was in Chicago, and it was a dealer, and I got the model I wanted. And I was paying for it, and there was a young man behind the counter, and he asked me if I was a Buddhist, and I said yes, and he said that he killed a deer by accident. He hit it with his car some years ago, and it's been always bothering him, he said, am I in trouble? And I wondered if he was putting me on, but he wasn't. He was very simply asking me, and so after a little while I said, no, intention is everything. And it was a very brief exchange. But I'm convinced that he was very sincere about that. And you might not expect it as a lawnmower, a snowblower, a dealership, kind of like a blue collar workman type employee. And he addressed stranger on this topic. On an even more deeper level, a few years ago I was spoke at the Buddha's birthday celebration, Hanamatsuri, in the Seattle temple, Buddhist temple, and they have what's called a MAP program, Ministerial Assistance Program. And this is where lay people, become assist resident minister there. And there was a man there and I was talking to him. He was a ministerial assistant, and I asked him, you know, what brought him to Buddhism. He was not raised a Buddhist. And he said, well, one thing was, now I think he was from the Midwest. He and his brother would go hunting. And they went with bow and arrow. Maybe it was one of those crossbows, you know. And I know a lot of them hunters, they just like to be outdoors, and they don't, what you might call, enjoy or be sadistic, but they enjoy the hunt. You know, there is something about, you know, being outdoors and hunting that, and I know a lot of hunters, they go out and they, even though they, whatever they're hunting, they don't, they're not successful, they just enjoy it. They have a good time. The camaraderie or whatever it is. And I think this fellow was like that. But one time he and his brother went out bow hunting, and they were successful. They shot a raccoon with an arrow, and it pinned the raccoon to the tree, to the trunk of a tree. And when they went up to it, this person said it was still alive, and the raccoon was looking at him. And the expression on that raccoon's eyes was, why? Why did you do this to me? And this man said that event changed his life. Needless to say, he never went hunting anymore. And in fact, he said for many years after that, he became a vegetarian, you know. For a while, and I think that was one of the events that he said, you know, if you know, he was a young man at the time, and he didn't formally become a Buddhist till much later. But these kind of impactful events were significant points in his spiritual journey, you know, that added to his karmic background of how his spiritual path unfolded, and it's still going on for him, you know. But that raccoon was his bodhisattva, so to speak, a great teacher. And sometimes it's through loss. In order for us to, if we talk about what we have to eat, or we kill microbes and bacteria, we kill microscopic things all the time. We, you know, in order for us to live, we have to consume living things, or what was living things, you know, in some form. In order for us to live, other things have to die. That's a fact of life, and it should sober us, you know. And the very least we could do is use our energy in the best possible way we can as we live our lives, you know, so that we don't take it for granted and we don't waste it. And that is one reason, I think, that we put our hands together, or grace is said before a meal. Very basic. We receive our life, very life, from others. And not only are we thankful, but that thankfulness should be deep and should be with compassion and a tapas there, that lives do have to be taken. It's not just sort of a selfish, oh, thank you, I am so thankful for this feast, but a very soberness to it, and that we should be very earnest. Okay. Well, that's all for today's broadcast, and indeed, I put my hands together in oneness and gratitude for all of you joining with us, and to our guest, Tamaseyo-san, for joining with us. And everyone, have a beautiful day. I think Adrian Gio Siles there is still on. Are you there? I unmuted you. Oh. Yeah, you're on. I'll mute you, but Gio Siles there. I wanted to talk to him.
Oh. Hi. Hi, Siles-san.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. How's
okay.
it going?
I'm good. I didn't hook up my microphone. I just listened to the speakers. So I had to run and get my microphone.
Were you able to do the semi-final version of the ID card? I thought we could email the file to all the lay ministers and all who are graduating this year and get their information. Hello? Oh, what happened? Are we still on, Sana?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I can't hear Sayo-san.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, now I can hear
okay.
you.
Well, I hooked up my microphone, and
yeah.
I forgot, I don't know, I'm having one of those weird technical, I'm sorry.
Technology is really a blast, huh?
It's really teaching me a lot. It's becoming my favorite Dharma teacher, really.
Yeah.
Just because you think you know, oh, yeah, I think I know enough about technology, it beats you right back down and says, no, you don't.
Yeah.
Yes, I finished all the designs with all the additions that you had given me. The problem is I ran out of ink, and what I have to do is I have to print out the ID card first, and then I scan it, and then I make it into a JPEG. So that's all I have to do, and I'll probably do that this afternoon after our meeting at the temple.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, very good. And then I'm going to start composing an email to attach that to.
Okay.
And the other thing I have to do is,
then?
Yeah, could you send
okay.
me the file, and then, you know, I'll just attach it or can forward whatever you send me
okay.
with a note. Yeah,
okay.
That'd be great. That'd be great.
Okay, yeah, I should do that then. I'm going to get ready because we have our Sunday.
Yeah.
After
How's that going?
Really good. We're having some new people coming in, and there's a lot of excitement. Sort of what Koyo Sensei was saying, that they appreciate that it's sort of in English, and it's not like they have to learn Sanskrit or Tibetan or Vietnamese or anything. It's all in English, which surprised a lot of them for some reason. They sort of equate Buddhism to like some sort of Asian language.
Yeah.
They're shocked when you know somebody speaks English and explain Buddhism in English without all the other stuff that kind of comes with it. So but it's been really good. I forgot to mention we are having the abbot wants us to they celebrate the Buddha's birthday at the end of the month, and they wanted us to come together as the two groups, and we're going to be doing a big festival. So I was going to take some pictures and share them with you and Sensei, but I forgot. I was going to write that in an email.
Is that in April? Because end of the month, May, is going to be our induction.
Oh, it, funny enough, it's the Sunday before our induction.
Oh, great, great.
It's the 23rd, and they want a lot of the communities to come together.
Yeah.
And the abbot really wants all our members that are coming to really join in together and again, because they don't really have that many people that speak English, she wants to sort of help, you know, be there and help newcomers to the celebration and that. So that was really exciting.
Terrific. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You may as well send on that email for the others to know, because there's some other people in Florida.
Yeah.
You know.
Morris Sekyo-san, he and I were always chatting back and forth about coming together and visiting each other's sanghas and stuff like that. And I'm not sure who else is in Florida.
I'll
is there
have
anybody
to look
else?
That up. I don't have it. I don't know offhand. I'll let you know if I got other. It might be just the two of you.
Okay. but yeah, I'll send that out this afternoon, and then you can go ahead and send it. You know, it'll just be the JPEG file, and then you can send whatever information. And then, like you said, they can have the option of putting their, their address or whatever. You know. Information they want to put there, and if they want to provide a picture, and then we'll work from there.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Okay, we'll talk to you later.
All right, we'll talk to you later then.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.